I'm going to take that further. It's quite likely that was you. And I just, was it last, not, I think it was last Friday. I was giving a talk about, it wasn't last Friday, it was the Sunday, the last Dharma class, super class I gave over at Dhammaloka. Now we got on to talking about near-death experiences, and somebody came up and told me that, you know, their daughter, you know, has got memories of past life, and whenever, she's about 4 years of age now, and whenever she talks about mummy, her little daughter says, which mummy, you or the other mummy? And she actually gave a name for her other mummy. This was an Australian girl, which was a Chinese name. And so she had a name of her previous mother, because she's only 4 or 5 years of age, a Chinese girl. They haven't checked it out yet. But, you know, sometimes that happens when you're very young. And a lot of times people don't say, because, again, they feel like it's causing a problem in their family, which is your right mother, or they feel that no one will believe them. And that's really, really not nice. So, you know, those memories should really be respected, because most of them are actually true. You know, sometimes that, you know, people think, oh, it can't be the case, but it is the case, and people do remember. So if you want to take it further, you know, the easiest way is to get a hypnotic regression. Now, some of you can't be hypnotized. The last retreat I gave, we talked about this, and one of the people here, she made an appointment, but she just could not get regressed. Some people can, some people can't. But, you know, you might try that with a hypnotic regressionist. It's just a very beautiful experience. They just relax you so much, and they make a few suggestions and see what comes up. And if that happens, you can actually get a bit more information about being a Catholic nun. See what happened. For me, I think it's really interesting to do that. You get a bigger picture, and it does explain a lot about who you are and why you do things. So, yeah, I'd go for that. So please do it. Happy 30th anniversary of Bodhinyana Monastery. 30 years had gone. 30 years to go? Oh, no, that means I'll be 92 before I can... Can't monks retire? They should be able to retire. You know, it's just I've done a lot of hard work, all this work, because, you know, we're thinking of building some more huts for the monks, just on that property next door here, because there's too many monks. And I thought, look, there's always having kutis, these individual huts, I mean, they fill up as soon as you build them. So why not really go for it and have a condo? Maybe, you know, 18, 20 stories. Now, we've got the space for it. Now, maybe 2 or 3 apartments or, you know, huts on each level. You know, the visitors, you guys will be down the bottom. Then we have the Anagarikas, the 8 preceptors. Then the 10 preceptors above that, the novices. Then we'll have the monks on the top. And then I could have my penthouse at the very top. Actually, isn't that a good idea? No? Okay, it's not a good idea. So, yeah, 30th anniversary. You keep on going. That's why we celebrated a little bit at Nolamara. It's Serpentine Day, but it's not a big deal. Okay, next question. About Libet stopping volition, I think even the free will is conditioned by causes, perhaps by confidence, contentment, chance. That's a good question. That's a good comment there. Because this guy, he was actually showing what you take to be your will is not what started the process. By the time you're aware of this thing that you recognize as will, it's already started and you can't stop it. But there is, you can stop it, you can actually say no, but it's not what starts. The readiness potential in the brain appears first. And then this thing you recognize as will comes afterwards. But yeah, I can actually stop it. That's why Libet was saying it's a free won't rather than a free will. So you can actually stop. That's what you can do. But isn't that conditioned? And I agree with you, that's conditioned as well. You let go because you're told to by you know who. And I was conditioned by Ajahn Chah to let go. And he was conditioned by somebody else to let go. And the chain of command goes all the way back to the Buddha. So he's the culprit. Why the Buddha taught cessation prior to the path? Is there sequential meaning behind that? Now that's an interesting question I haven't had before. the cessation, the letting go. I think it was really what he was saying, the third noble truth was saying, look, there is an end to this. So, you know, say that, you know, this thing can stop. And this is how it stops, by the practice. And in that third noble truth, he got the four ways of letting go. Maybe I'll give a talk about that later on. I've given many talks about that. The four ways of letting go is giving, expecting nothing back in return. So you give to the meditation. You don't expect things back. That's actually quite nice for the Australian government. If you give a donation to a building fund, you can actually get tax deductibility. You can cut that off your income. But if you get something for it, for example, Ananda, if you give a donation to the Nuns Monastery, say of $100, if your name is put on a list on the wall, you cannot claim tax deductibility. You get something back. So it's a beautiful thing, because real giving is anonymous. No one knows. In other words, you know, you're just giving, not expecting anything back in return. That is real giving. And I love those types of giving, when people give and they come from the most weird sources, and it's just really inspiring. And they say, no, don't tell you who it is. And even once, one of the best gifts, because I say that all these people, they give all these gifts. Who can actually give a gift with such trust, they give me a blank check? And just, I gave that talk once, and one person actually did that. They had it signed at the bottom, you know, to BSWA, and they told me, Ajahn Brahm, you fill in the amount. Isn't that wonderful? You know what I filled in? Zero. And I gave it back to him to put on his wall. So that, you know, just to show that, you know, that's a wonderful thing he did, but I will never ever abuse such stuff. You gonna give that a try? How about you trust me? That's wonderful. I gave you a blank check once from somebody. You just write whatever you want on it. And I wrote zero. That's what, you know, he said, whatever I want, that's what I want. I want nothing. That's why I have a Christian some time ago came up to me trying to convert me and say, nothing is better than God. I said, yes, exactly. Nothing is much better than God. So we had this wonderful interfaith dialogue. Anyway, let's go there. So I think cessation was because, you know, saying it's possible and letting go, and then how to let go was the fourth noble truth. But we'll get into that later on. Please explain Vibhavadanha with Mega Metta. Okay, the cravings. Vibhavadanha is the craving to destroy, to get rid of. That's almost like the anger-eating demon. Get out of here, you don't belong. And that is just a different type of controlling. So, you know, get rid of, you know, bring up to have, that is always thinking you're controlling. That never gets you anywhere. Instead, we have let things be, let it go. So you don't try and stop it, you don't try and start it. You welcome it, like the demon. And then if you welcome things, it disappears by itself. So the anger-eating demon simile, get out of here, I don't want to be reborn again. I've had enough. You will get reborn again. It's a different type of craving. It's more wanting. Or the best way of describing that was something which I remember reading in Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist, when one of the people in that book had the wonderful phrase, if he returns that £1, that £5 note, then I'll eat my own head, this guy used to say. And you can imagine, how can you eat your own head? It's impossible to eat your own head. You can say it, but you cannot do it. That's like trying to end yourself. That's Vibhavadanha, trying to stop your own rebirth. That's you trying to stop you. It doesn't work that way. That's trying to eat your own head. It's impossible. That's Vibhavadanha. I remember one of your talks. Oh my goodness, that's the trouble. I give so many talks, I say so many things. I'm about to get into trouble sometimes, and here we go again. I remember in one of your talks you mentioned of the, if all the army soldiers better formed by Buddhists, if there's a choice. Hang on. Maybe one of your talks you mentioned, I think I was mentioning about these guys I met in England who were Buddhists and who were in the army, the British army. And I thought they were just going to be like accountants or dentists or something, because an army has to have all those people as well. But these were frontline soldiers and they were Buddhists. And in the end I thought, well, I'd rather have Buddhists as soldiers than other people, because at least, you know, they're sort of compassionate and they don't sort of get angry at the people they're fighting. If there's a choice, how about parents? To be environmental friendly and with limited source in earth, should Buddhist parent have less children, but then the population of this group of good people will be getting less? It will support Sangha and Dhamma. Okay, what you're saying is if, as a Buddhist, you know, should you have children? Because if you have children, the world is already overpopulated. That's the biggest problem with the environment. And I always say that monks and nuns, especially people who are ordained very young, are doing the very, very, very best for the environment. You know, I'm lessening the population. And I think in a good way to lessen the population growth of all countries is to have every other second man become a monk and every second woman become a nun, and have all that sponsored by the World Wildlife Fund. Because that would reduce the world's population very quickly, and all the habitats for the world wildlife, because that's a problem. Human beings are encroaching because there's too many of us. So in order to lessen, not the one-child policy, because the one-child policy in China is fraught with difficulties and problems. So not, you can have two children in China or in any other country, but the second child has to be a monk. Or a nun. Why not? Because waste of time, it's not being sort of religious or anything, because, you know, all the other religions, you know, all their priests have kids. It's only monks, or maybe Christian monks as well. We're the ones who sort of are celibate. So they should all be monks or nuns. And that way, we'll actually lessen the world population. So it's a very good idea. But if you're not a monk and you have a kid, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a bad thing in the sense of increasing the population, but it's a good thing. At least you're giving beings a chance to listen to the Dhamma and practice the Dhamma. So you know, if you're a good person and you've got a good livelihood, and you're living in a good country, then maybe this is a good idea. You're allowing a person to come into this world and practice the Dhamma. And they say, what happens if support the Sangha and the Dhamma, you need more people? Look, we get too much support. Look how fat we are. Look how much food comes over here. Those of you who went to Bodhinyana, there's too much people supporting the Sangha. It's very true, you know. So we need less supporters and more people to support. We need more monks and nuns. There's plenty of support. There's not enough people being monks or being nuns. It's a wonderful career choice. Okay, the money's not so good. But the retirement benefits are out of this world. Dear Ajahn, how can you practice contentment and also practice seeing the suffering in all things? Thanks with metta. Remember what I said, service and solitude? There are times when you're in solitude, when you relax, you let go. That's when you are content. And then there's a service when you try and do something to lessen the suffering in this world. But you know, a lot of people, they try and lessen the suffering in this world, and what do? Make more suffering. How many governments had the war to end all wars? No, the military campaign to bring peace into the world. How many people do that? Are the demonstrations in Bangkok so that we can at last have a good government in Thailand? Isn't this the case that sometimes, you know, we think we're doing something good, we end up making more problems? So this is sometimes that it's a time when we just learn how to be content for a little while. And when we're content for a little while, when we can be really still, we can get a lot more wisdom. And half of the wars and the demonstrations and the violence in this world will be seen for what it is. Well-meaning People have got good intentions, but they don't know really how to achieve the goals of peace and harmony in this world. You don't get that through violence or through war. You know, you get that through other ways, which are much more difficult, and they take a much longer time. They don't give the quick fixes which politicians need. It's the long-term perspective is what we should be doing. So that's how we can end suffering. And one way in politics is to have a system. I gave a talk on human rights at Curtin. I was giving all these weird ideas, but weird ideas sometimes gain traction. Democracy is a bad form of government, as Churchill said, but it's the best of a bad lot, the best we've actually got. But how to improve democracy is, why should a person who is, say, 80 years of age, who's about to leave this world, have the same vote as someone who's, say, 20, who's got all their life in front of them? If you have shares in a company, the more shares you have, the more votes you have to decide the decisions of that company. So a 20-year-old has more shares in this life than an 80-year-old. So why don't we adjust the voting power according to people's ages? So maybe from 18 to 30, you have a full vote. From maybe 30 to 50, half a vote. 50 to 70, a quarter of a vote. And after 70, you're out of here soon. You've got no investment, you know, in whatever happens. So no vote at all. It would make a great change to politics, because young people would have far more influence. And these are the people who are going to be sent to the wars. These are the people who are going to have to deal with climate change when it happens. Skewing politics or democracy to people who have got more stake in the outcome. It's a reasonable idea, and it means all these old people who are what usually become prime ministers and presidents, they're out of there. Interesting idea. So why not? How do we maintain stillness when we are not sitting meditation? It's, you can't really. That's why sitting meditation is the best. Lying down meditation can be still. But you know, this is actually why we do sitting meditation. It's the best possible way to get real stillness. But even if you are eating your food, you can be much more still, you know, than an ordinary person eating their food. Because when people are eating their food, they're talking to each other. They're thinking about whatever, fantasizing. They're not really eating their food. Which is why I say that when you start this meditation, you find that you can actually eat properly. Which means that when you're having your meal, you're not talking to somebody else. I've seen this. People go to these expensive restaurants where people spend a huge amount of money making this incredibly delicious food. And do you taste it? No, you're talking to somebody else while you're eating your food. How can you actually pay attention to what you're eating when you're having an interesting conversation with somebody else? Okay, if you go to McDonald's, you can talk whatever you want because it's, you know, trashy food. But if you go to a really expensive restaurant, you have to pay a lot of money, please tell your partner or your boyfriend and girlfriend, shut up, I paid a lot of money for this, I want to enjoy it. And that's what happens. And if you're not thinking, you can actually taste more. Which is one of the reasons why that when you're eating here, see if you can eat silently. And also just taste every morsel of the food, which people spend a lot of time trying to make delicious for you. And you'll find if you can taste it and appreciate it, more saliva is secreted in your mouth, more bile and thus other stuff which you need to digest the food gets secreted, which means your digestion gets far better. One of the reasons people do have digestive problems is because they're not paying attention, so the food is not really appreciated, which means all this stuff doesn't come out of your system to digest things. makes a lot of sense to me. So when you're mindful, you're aware, and you put your full attention into eating, you really appreciate every morsel instead of thinking fantasies or talking to the person next to you or looking out the window to see what's going on. No, you know, just pay attention to what you're tasting, and you become much better with digesting your food. That's my problem. I don't eat that much, but I digest it so well. So much of it gets into my body. It much gets absorbed. When my mind... I've got all these excuses for being fat. You know, my best one is, because I've been telling a lot of people this, that the longer you are a monk or a nun, the more compassion you get. Which means your heart gets bigger and bigger and bigger, pushing out your chest, making you appear fat. It's not fat, it's just a big heart, taking up more space, needing a bigger container. So skinny people must be really small-hearted and mean and nasty. When my mind wanders to the past or future scenes, and as soon as I notice it, I remember, red flag, alert, and come back to the person. Is this a recommended technique, or is it exercising my willpower content? It's restraining. It's the will to say no. So it's good, yeah. And after a while, you get trained, you know, to come and stay in the present moment. And it's a much nicer place to stay. You're actually here. You're alive. Dear Ajahn, do stream enterers know they are stream enterers? Once returned, know they are once returned. And arahats know they are arahats. If so, then how can they be sure? A lot of times this is a big problem, because people think they're stream enterers, and they ain't. Think they're arahats, and they're not. And you all know my story when I became enlightened. People ask me, were you enlightened? And I tell the story when I became enlightened. Are you interested? No, maybe I'll leave it to next week. I wrote about this in my book, and it's got a nice ending to it. 4 years I'd been a monk, and my meditation was really getting very hot. And one evening, it was really powerful. Walking meditation, sitting meditation, really still. And when I went to do some walking meditation, all these incredible insights just came pouring down, like being under a waterfall. Things I'd never seen before. Understanding deepest truths. All the answers just so clear. And whenever you get an insight, you get so much happiness with it. And then, it must have been about 10 o'clock at night or 10:30, then the big one came. Wow. Now I understood everything. And just my meditation was just effortless, just so still. And this was so wonderful, being enlightened. And I thought I should go and get a rest. But you lay down, you can't sleep. You've got too much energy, too much stillness. And then I got up. You had to get up 3 o'clock in the morning. I got up at 2. I didn't get up. I hadn't really gone to bed. 2:30, I was meditating. I'm not sleepy at all. Just perfectly straight, poised, without any effort or problem at all. It's so wonderful being enlightened. And the chanting, just perfect tone. Everything is amazing when you're enlightened. And then we went on the alms round in the morning, and I was giving all this wonderful loving kindness to all these people who had the great opportunity to give their food into the bowl of an arahat. And just, you're so blessed. And then we came for our meal, and I was surprised. Because every morning in this monastery, we'd have our sticky rice. That's all we got on alms round. Would have the same old stew of rotten fish curry. Every day was the same. And it was rotten fish. These were very simple villagers in the northeast of Thailand. They just catch the fish in the rainy season, and they just bung them into a jar, put a piece of plastic on the top, and leave them to rot. They stank. Bangkok people couldn't stand the rotten fish curry. There's a few people from Thailand here. Now, you hate that stuff, and let alone being a Westerner. But, you know, you got used to rotten fish curry again. But this today, there was another pot. And when I looked at it, it was a pork curry. Now, you know, we don't have no choice about being vegetarians or not in those days. And that was actually, you know, edible. And so straight away I thought, this is amazing. You know, the heavenly beings have decided to give a pork curry today to celebrate my enlightenment. Because even even heavenly beings, they like to get a piece of the action too. And I thought, wow, isn't this amazing? You know, the day of my enlightenment, they give this beautiful curry. And so the tradition was only about 6 or 7 monks in this monastery. I was the number 2 monk there. So the senior monk, you know, he had the first dibs, the first, you know, spoon. And I couldn't believe just, you know, this monk, they had a big ladle, about 3 or 4 ladles. No one could eat that much of the pork curry. But, you know, there was lots in there, so I thought there's plenty for me. But before he passed it down, he took the rotten fish curry pot and poured it all into the pork curry and stirred it up, saying, "It's all the same, it's all the same." After taking his first. I think, what a bloody hypocrite. If it's all the same, why don't you take some rotten fish curry? You know, you spoil my enlightenment lunch. And at that point, I realized I was angry. I can't be enlightened after all. That's definitely a true story. And, you know, from that moment, if you've ever been enlightened and realized suddenly you're not, you don't care what you're eating. I bunged in. I didn't care anymore. I was so depressed. It was nice when it lasted, though. So I recommend being enlightened, but it's really a downer when you realise you're not. So that's why you've got to be very careful. That's why, you know, sometimes people think they're enlightened, but the only way you can really find out is, you know, having somebody mix the food you don't like with the food you do like and see what happens. That's why you try and get people upset. You know, if like Bali says you know you're enlightened, they say, no, women can't become enlightened. See what the reaction is. What? Women are just equal to men in Buddhism. So, okay, yeah, they are equal, but you've just lost it, so you're not enlightened. That's what we usually do. Try and get, you know, people to test them out to see if they are or they're not. Because sometimes you can be deluded. Sometimes you can be so peaceful and so blissed out for days. And then it all falls apart. Close, but not quite. What's the difference between mindfulness and meditation? Can I leave that to later on? I'll give another talk on what mindfulness is later on, because it's one of the most misunderstood words in today's world. And we have so much mindfulness this and mindfulness that, and it's not really mindfulness, but, you know, it works. It makes people a bit more peaceful and happy and solve some problems. But I'll defer that to another day when I talk about mindfulness in more fully. What is the best type of meditation a layperson should do every day? Thank you. There's just stillness meditation is the best. But anyway, for what you do when you leave here, I'll wait till you leave here. I'll do that a bit later. If this question is okay to go on record, please answer. If not, I will ask you later. So a monk in Thailand said the Mahasi Sayadaw technique can get people into deep meditation easily, but eventually they will get stuck. As metta and anapanasati are more difficult to make big progress, but they lay a solid foundation, and once you get in, you will advance beautifully. Please comment. It is true that, actually, Mahasi Sayadaw himself, he taught the so-called vipassana technique to mostly to lay people. When it came to samadhi, or to monks, he taught them a different way. And I remember that because he actually once visited England when he was still alive, and when someone was talking about sort of, you know, the sound of silence technique, Mahasi said, if it's really meditation, you don't hear any sound at all. And to me, that was saying that this guy, you know, knew what jhana was. So this was a fellow who was supposed to be teaching just insight, but he did that as almost like a second-class meditation for lay people. And they're not teaching the whole thing of jhanas. Because every monk in Burma knows that, you know, without jhanas, there's no enlightenment. And somehow that's taken off now, the disciples of Maharaj Sayadaw, or say this is, you can get enlightened all that way. But you can't. You have to need jhanas to get enlightened. So, yeah, it gets you so far, but you really have to do things like metta and anapanasati to get into the jhanas to get really enlightened. Without being still, you can't see things as they truly are. And the stillness is a deep jhanas, stages of stillness. I read that craving for non-existence, vibhavadana, is also strengthening the idea of self. Yeah, I said that. Please explain. For many years, I often say to myself, I wish this is my last birth. After seeing kids struggling at school, marriages, divorces, peer pressure, all relatives die one by one, I just lose interest. Yeah, but the thing is, you are wishing that you don't get reborn. You are doing that. You are trying to control the process. All controlling, all desire, is what builds up this sense of self. And the more you try and control, the more you struggle, the stronger your sense of self is. That's why it's so difficult for people to let go. Because to let go, you have to disappear. I shouldn't have really said that, because that's actually giving almost like a game away. When I say let go, when you really let go, you think, you know, you've gone. There's no me here anymore. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, I say on every